Anyway.
Yeah, it's an amazing film, yeah. Actually, wasn't it? I enjoyed that in the theatre. It's one of the great classic films.
Staying Alive was the sequel.
Oh, was it? Oh, yes, Staying, it was
not
called...
So good.
Yeah, no, Staying Alive wasn't so good. The actual, the first one was brilliant. And, yes, it'll be interesting teaching with a Bee Gee. Well, he's not actually a Bee Gee. He was married to a Bee Gee, so he's almost a Bee Gee.
Yeah, she doesn't have the same aura as a Bee Gee, I don't
know.
No.
I don't know, I've never met a Bee Gee, is he? So I don't know what they would be like if you actually met a Bee Gee.
They've got teeth.
They did have very nice teeth.
Yeah, they have good teeth, but quite a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, no, it's true. It's interesting though, isn't it, actually? You think of the that film. I don't know what I'm talking about this, but anyway, it's one of those things that, you know, so you make the gesture, right? So you did the Staying Alive gesture, the Tony, you know, Tony in the white suit thing. And immediately a whole world appears. It's one of those. It's one of these archetypal things that, you know, that is in the collective of those of a certain generation who saw it. You know, and suddenly immediately you're there. It's very kind of I think that it is a bit connected to this idea. We come to the sense of the deep because we come into the collective. We come into collective fields. We come even into this question of, you know, is there one sleeper? Lots of sleepers. One in the many. What is identity? Well, you know, on the surface, my identity is very separate and very distinct. And Becky's phrase of the singular language, but the common experience applies when you go into a certain degree of depth. So there's something identity changes, and you're much more in a field of collective experience, ancestors, fungi, organic material, the substrata of life somewhere. But I think that's what happens when we kind of, as we pursue this work and as we get more connected to the deep in ourselves, we become, in a way, we do become this creature that is part of the deep sea, therefore is affected by the currents that are running through the sea and connected to the other deep life of the collective pool of awareness in some ways. And it's interesting, the exercises we were looking at just before really, that is about the dreamer and the sleeper wake, in some ways plays with that idea, or the idea of something that's in the deep who dreams us, or do we dream them? Who's dreaming who? Who's creating who? It takes us into a kind of a more ambiguous contemplation, really, of wakeness and sleeping. And that's always that question around everything to do with the imaginal, what is real, what's unreal. And of course the ultimate answer is it's all real, actually, in its own way. But the thing that's interesting, and it's just interesting about the Staying Alive gesture, is that when you have that, that's evoked into the room. I imagine what then starts to happen is just even in that gesture, just by Roberta doing it and thinking about it and humming a little bit of it, you get all kinds of constellations of images and ideas start to appear that have their own life and are contagious in a certain sense. You know, so suddenly we're talking about Bee Gees and Bee Gees' teeth and suddenly something starts to run that has its own life. So whenever you invite anything in, almost, but certainly in any group context, you quickly find that thing does its own thing. There's a sort of that place where the things that we encounter in the imaginal are both private and personal, and both impersonal and public simultaneously. Very kind of curious thing in some ways.
Actually, it's the constellation of Orion.
What is the constellation of Orion?
That gesture.
Oh, the gesture. I like that idea.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that. So I shall be able to think of John Travolta in the heavens as he rises this time of year, inviting us all to stay alive. I'll feel the beat. That's really true as well. That works. I like that.
He's John of the Gospels.
He is also John of the Gospels. That's right. That's why he's also Anthropos, that's right. But that...
he is a Scientologist.
I don't care. Yeah, well, I don't know. Well, you know, whatever. He made a good film. He made a good film. And actually, interestingly, a film that was full of life, you know, because that film's an interesting film, and it's about creativity. It's all about creativity and creativity through the body.
And breaking free.
And breaking free of your circles. Absolutely, yeah. Breaking free of your patterns and sort of, and there's that, you know. Okay. Yeah, so it's a powerful kind of film somewhere. And in a way, that's the point, I think. Why do we study these things? Why do we kind of pay attention? It is ultimately about breaking free, allowing the increase of life. You know, that sort of idea of you get in the Gospel of John, in him was life, and the life was the light of men, right? So there's something about light, the manifestation of light and darkness, and the increase of life as we apply ourselves to these things. But what happens though, as we start to practice this and do this more regularly, what you experience is the sense of this wider, deeper world that you're connected to, and that therefore can connect to you. I remember my friend Stuart Littlejohn, who's responsible for most of the pictures in this room, not all, but most, talking about that when he makes an artwork, he feels that he creates a doorway, and his art certainly is that. For me, his art often functions as a doorway, and I look at the one of his pictures, and it seems to connect me, seems to take me somewhere. But the other thing he says about his work, the other thing that he realizes, is that a sort of inner energy or imaginal energy comes actually through the picture. And he often experiences when he's painting very strange and particularly because he's in the process of creating, the image is not fully formed. He often experiences chaotic and sort of and powerful energies coming into his life as a result of making a picture. When at the moment he's doing a picture of the fate goddess Anke, who He's had to change his image because his first image was of her just threads just manifesting in all directions out of the picture. And what he found is that he found his life suddenly forking in all kinds of directions and sort of in too many threads and too much to hold. And so he's created a more contained image where within a serpent going in a circle, which he's kind of working with, which has somehow settled that energy, you know, still a very powerful image and represents what he wants to get at. But it's somehow settled the energy so he can paint it and not feel so chaotic. And in a way, that's the point, I think, of as you tap into the deep imaginal, you become a creature of the depths, but also you have to live with the other creatures of the depths. You have to live with the other energies that see you, that manifest, that connect to you when you do that. So as a certain, and it is this difficult thing, difficult because of the way you've been taught, to realize that these images or experiences, while simultaneously being personal, private and particular, are also public and common. And increasingly, as we experience the depths and enter the depths, we encounter energies that are not just ours. Talked a little bit about this yesterday when we were talking about people like the Serbian general, taps into very ancient history. But it's there for all of us. We've all got our families, our nations, all have their own living history that is active in the imaginal world. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things for me was when we had Blair and Bush doing the whole Crusader thing. And very actively, you could hear them using these images, really, of kind of, and Blair in particular identifying the White Knight image, and you know, freeing people from the yoke of slavery and oppression, and the, you know, and well, what arises in response to that in that land is the image of the caliphate, very ancient Islamic image. Now, there's obviously all kinds of political reasons and other reasons why that arises, money reasons as well, because it's probably funded by the Saudis. But imagistically, you have the Crusader image gets evoked, and the Islamic Caliphate, who is the counter image to that, gets evoked. And it's in a certain sense, on inner levels, there's a sense of the Crusades being fought again. You know, and
what is the Caliphate?
The Caliph is in Islam. The Caliph is the spiritual head of Islam, and the Caliph has the authority to call the warriors of Islam to jihad, to holy war against the infidel. So the last Caliph was Damascus. It was got rid of by the Ottoman Empire, right? Who didn't fancy an existent Caliphate because it was a challenge to the authority of the Sultan. So as an actual physical thing, the Caliphate has been gone for a couple of hundred years, but it's sort of interesting in response to the West coming into the Middle East, you get the revival of the image of the Caliphate, and the you know and quite you know the ISIS people were quite blatantly saying we have come to restore the Caliphate, we summon the warriors of Islam to jihad against the infidel of the West who are invading our lands. So it's a very interesting, you know, it's a kind of interesting sort of counter movement to the actual movement of that kind of crusading energy that arose in Europe. You know, and it's a sort of, and it was the other thing that you saw on the heels of all that Bush and Blair thing, was that the sudden, apparently spontaneous Arab Springs that suddenly appeared everywhere, suspiciously, from my point of view, which have kind of melted down, which have caused the Middle East to melt down. You know, Libya's total chaos, Syria's a nightmare. And there's something about that, the clash of those energies, and there'll be all kinds of political things that we'll never know about underneath all of that. But actually, at that imagistic level, what we're seeing is a new version of the Crusades playing out. Because in a way, that's what happens with as we know, what happens with patterns in human beings is patterns, if not interrupted or transformed in some way, they repeat. Similarly, in collective culture. Now, the capacity to sort of be present with the deep and allow the deep to come into this it starts to transform our sense of identity. So when we sink down into the depths and we find that sense of completeness and stillness, now that is paralleled by another movement, which is the depth arising up through us, connecting us consciously to not just to our sense of ourself, but our sense of that kind of wider culture. Now, people who can do that consciously or unconsciously become connected with something powerful. So it's a powerful thing to kind of to touch into those energies, and something that can needs handling. Doing it consciously is a very good idea because you have therefore possibility of being able to integrate it and kind of not get lost in archetypal energies. There are, however, a lot of people, and certain politicians in particular, who tap into that archetypal energy aren't with it consciously, but unconsciously ride it, and therefore ride it sometimes into very powerful positions. Now, one of the things you find in stratas of myth in most traditions, though, is the idea of the sleeper, which is where this last little bit has come from. Because the sleeper who dreams the earth in a way represents that kind of creative energy in the depths. Merlin's one of the classic sleepers of British tradition, or so is Arthur. But figures like Sleeping Beauty, the Black Madonnas, who are sometimes thought of being as figures sleeping in the earth, they represent something whose time has not quite yet come, but whose energies are arising in the way that dreams arise, arising to inform us of things that have not yet happened, but are starting to emerge. And the dreamers are often thought of as, or the sleepers are thought of as oracular figures who mediate between the sort of the source of existence and the surface world. And the dreams of the sleepers form matrices or shapes which enable that creative energy of the depth to start to make its way into shape and substance. Now we know in our own experience that as we relate to sleep and dreaming, that if we listen to our dreams, and those of us who might be experienced at doing that, one of the things that dreams show you is things you haven't thought about. That's why Freud talks about dreams as the royal road to the unconscious. Our conscious thoughts, conscious patterns are circumscribed by our known experience. Now, we have all kinds of ways of interrupting that, which is what we're doing here. But one of the other ways that just happens every night is we dream. Conscious mind, is conscious sensor isn't there. And what can arise there for our images, thoughts, experiences that are trying to find their way into being, but haven't been able to get past the confines of the known personality shape. So similarly, on a collective level, when you touch the dreamer, when you touch the sleeper, you can experience things that are trying to find their way through, but haven't yet been able to do that. Now, the task of, in some ways, creative artists of whatever kind tap the dreaming of the earth in this way. We say they could touch, in a way, you could say they're touching versions of sleepers, and allowing new dreams to emerge, new visions to emerge on earth. It's often why the new and new creative art, when it emerges, is always appallingly disruptive, and people mostly hate it. First of all, you have to look, if you look at people like Beethoven, when they first, it's regarded as the vilest music. Now it's become assimilated, we love it, we resonate with it, but in the beginning the new vision is destructive, as it has to be, because it's breaking down old patterns and ideas. The other thing that the dreamer connects, because the other thing that the dream of the dreamer, or the dream of the sleeper connects us with the deep places of the earth and the history, because he is this liminal figure that's about the future, but also about the past. Because it is this figure, often the dreamers are kind of culture heroes. They are people like Arthur and Merlin and Nimue, who's also held in the stone. So they are these figures who are sort of in the earth, connected to the life, the history that's gone before them, and transmitting something of that, and transmitting of something of what needs to emerge from the past into the future, through contact with those of us who in the present can touch that level of experience. Now sometimes the doing of that can be very, very destructive. I mean, Hitler being the great case in point, who touches in a sense the sleeping energy of Wotan, the god of war and storm and racial blood and purity, and brings that energy right out to the surface and enacts it out. Other times, in the experiences of some of the great religious teachers, the people like the Buddha, Christ, in their beginning days, they bring a new thing into being that has creativity and life and reframes what has gone before. Buddha's interesting because actually what Buddha did in his beginning was to completely reframe the framework of Indian religion. This is a long, long talk, which I won't bore you with, but the essentials of Buddhism not only are original and creative, they also take the older history of Indian religion and turn it on its head. Also Christ, right? Who tears the temple down symbolically and rebuilds it. who takes Hebrew religion and puts it into a completely different framework. So these are the two dimensions that arise as you tap into these deep places and consciously embody them. They can be used for destruction. They can be used for great creative purposes. Now, increasingly, as we go on with these last weekends of our work together, we're looking at how to manage, work with these collective energies. So in a sense, we're looking at how do you work with the soul of the United Kingdom? How do you work with the soul of England, the soul of Wales, the soul of Scotland, the soul of Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, the soul of Europe? Because the task of those for those who are just able to be conscious and present with these collective energies, you find yourself, if you are able to do that and you let yourself do that, you find yourself working with living beings, energetic beings, energetic shapes and forms that sometimes need help, sometimes need to be worked on. And the last but one workshop we'll be doing, we're going to look at the healing of the gods, which is working with the deep kind of archetypes. What we're going to go on to do next time is to look at the process of working with transition and transformation. As you tap into this and as you change your identity, not only do you transition, but the world around you transitions. And it's that idea that by being present, holding opposites together, holding this thread really, which connects the surface and the surface and the deep, we become in ourselves a bit like the philosopher's stone, or indeed like the grail itself, which creates regeneration around itself through the simple act of being and allowing whatever needs to emerge in the moment.
Stone, like the philosopher's stone.
Yeah.
And that's why we're connecting to it.
Yes, that was one of my other reasons for having a stone. Because the thing about the prayer stone is a stone. It's something you hold and touch, but it connects you, and it's something, because in a way that the fundamental thing that we're looking at when we hold our stone or when we do any of this work is just being. We become hologos, the continuing conversation. In a sense, you're saying, ego imi hologos, I am the conversation. I exist as the conversation.
Logos, L-O-G-O-S.
Yes. I exist as the living conversation. I am so this idea of the person who possesses the philosopher's stone or possesses the grail. That's why Bors is, this figure of the knight Bors who just goes home. In some ways, he's the deepest grail winner of all, because all he does is go home, but he brings the grail home with him quietly. No stories about him, because he's simply, through the act of just being and being the grail, is continuing to regenerate the world all around himself. Not in a dramatic way, but in whatever way. And that's literally what we do. When we get present in this way, we find things, regeneration happens. In whatever way that it does. And it happens in the negative, I am now the grail, excellent, I am causing regeneration. Nothing would happen if you did that, because actually the process of being the grail is this process of connection between opposites. And an act of relaxation that allows something to happen that never feels like yours. Because in order to relax, in order to be with that place of opposite, that sense of this is me doing something vanishes. So it never feels like you. It just feels like it's happening around you. Often, mostly. And you're not even sure if you've got anything to do with it a lot of the time. Any questions or thoughts just this summer? I'm going to finish by just reading another of David Jones's poems, just to recall The Sleeping Lord. It's kind of relevant. But and see if there's any questions or final thoughts before we wrap it up, really.
So,
yep.
So my sense is that we are all things and nothing.
Yeah, that's right. But that absolutely so, right? So we are nothing for sure, and then we arise as all things, and then we specifically arise as ourself in particular circumstances.
Mm.
Yeah, both. So we're three things. We were all things, we're all things, no thing, and one thing. But that one thing keeps changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just that hard to understand. Well, this is what they did yesterday. It really gives. A perspective on what a human being is, and I was thinking, oh, it's got vertebrae and muscles, and it's got like all these little wormy things that oh, that's what's a relative, which you don't really aware of until you think of what you're like relative to the stone.
Yes, that's right.
And then you become aware of all sorts of things that you wouldn't, you know,
another
because
way
we can't, you know, we go through life every day and get, you know, like,
yeah.
Aware of our actual physical nature,
yeah.
Really, because we take it for granted. But when you can look at with the narration of the stone, you become very aware of how, in what ways we are different from the stone.
Yes, that's right, and that's one of the powerful things about working with a stone like that.
And you can only see yourself through relationship. You don't really aware of it until you relate yourself to something else.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. So that's one of the powerful things about just holding the stone. It brings that awareness present in a way that it wouldn't be otherwise.
So we know what we are by what we are not.
Again. Yeah, again, but, same thing, absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
So if you step out then and look at the universe for a moment.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense of it kind of beating? So it goes out into the everything and then back into the nothing. And
yeah.
Is it that sense?
That's what I experience. I mean, that sense of everything flickering, everything sort of expansion, contraction. It is a bit like, I suppose you could call it like a heartbeat. I suppose it
feels
like that.
That sort of fractured.
But that fractured very, very fast. Yes, exactly.
So I get that all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's right. I think that's how things are. Things flicker. Right. The apparent solidity is movement.
Mm.
Right, so that's the point. Everything flickers and everything is in constant relationships, a constant conversation. Right? Whereas you've obviously got to be reasonably awake to notice, to let us have noticed that, because otherwise when we dell out a bit, we come away from that into the world of things. But when you get present into that, that's it. Everything is kind of shimmering slightly. Mm. Yeah. And from that point of view, you really never know what you're going to do or what you're going to say, because it comes out of that shimmering. That's what happens.
It's very bit difficult to have a business plan around that, I'm finding.
It is. So that's a dilemma. Holding the shimmering and holding the need for the business plan or the need for money, as you and I know, is something. Those are two of the opposites that hold there, and then we'll see what comes out of that.
Mm.
Yeah. Very curious person. I expect you are too, Bex.
Yeah, I'd love to know.
I know you would. So do I.
Can you say something a bit about how intimacy relates to this? Because to me, it seems to be something around contact and contact with one's own being, but also contact with other beings. And how does it kind of...
Well, I think the reality...
I'm not sure how it quite fits together.
Well, it fits together, I think, because as you become intimate with yourself like this, you become intimate with everything. You know, we're talking about increasing intimacy.
Mm.
And in a way, that's one of the difficulties, challenges of this, is it can feel a bit naked, because as you become present with yourself and therefore present with everybody else, you start to discover, yeah, deepening degrees of intimacy, which you have to learn to handle, I think. So it's, I think it's one of the, because it's, in some ways, this is quite naked, you know, you suddenly, so when you step away out of the world of solid things into this world of shimmering processes, we could say, then that's the place, that's why presence is really important, because presence becomes your way of handling the potential overwhelm of that.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the key things, because actually the real of entering this and feeling connected to everything, and I affect you, you affect me, you know, and really, and feeling that, not just knowing that in the mind, you know, if we can get very present with that and we relax into that, then that can be fine. Paradoxically, if we get frightened by that and we try and fight it, it becomes quite overwhelming. So it's actually the act of relaxing into intimacy, almost so that those energies move through us, that enables us to manage intimacy, so that we relax into being intimate with everything. But it, you know, it's an important question, I think, because actually that's what happens. So you feel, so you know, for example, the reality of being intimate with Donald Trump is actually one of the things, you know, it's nice to feel intimate with stars or trees or something like that, but of course it's Tony Blair, Donald Trump, you know, sort of the that awful church in the States that hates gay people. It, suddenly all of that you're connected to somewhere. And then, okay, so how do we do that? Well, we do that, of course, by relaxing into that deeper sense of self that can handle that. If I, as Ian, try to do that, I get squished, of course, because it's too much for me. But because the deeper nature is bigger and can handle intimacy, and in fact, is, you know, I suppose we could say its nature is presence and love. And so it has the capacity and delight almost in discovering new intimacies. So that's a much easier place then, I think. But staying with that's not always easy.
Yeah, I think you've just clarified something for me there, because I suppose I find it difficult to feel that A, I have to love everyone, and B, everyone is an aspect of me, especially the ones that particularly irritate me. But I kind of, if I'm going to drop from that place into something much bigger or deeper, there's a little bit of me, the cheeky part of me wants to go, well, then I'm not so responsible, am I? Because but I am.
And not.
I quite like the and not.
It's and, you see. That's the thing. It's not but and, really. Things,
yeah.
That's the key.
I like that.
And that's the thing of the paradox of the opposites there, really. So I'm responsible and not. It's me and not me.
Yeah.
That's what
John was saying yesterday.
Yeah, that's exactly what John was saying yesterday. Everyone's responsibility. It's me and then... I'm wholly, wholly with everything.
So it's all in the end. It's
all in the end. All in the end, indeed. It is that. The and is the conjunction, the thing that connects. And connects. Alchemical terms, conjunctio, the thing that brings opposites together to create the new thing.
Both and, not either or. Isn't
yeah, like that. That's it, both and, that's right.
Both and, not either or.
Yeah, I suppose that's right, and I think it's that both and then that continually opens us to the wider and deeper sense of self and sense of life. That's the challenge, really.
The challenge with Trump, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I'm just thinking back to this crusade thing, because politicians do use these images quite deliberately, but they're so embedded into the national psyche that actually no one can call them on them.
Oh, I know, yeah, totally.
So no one in opposition could stand up and say, the Crusaders were a load of thugs.
Yeah, no, totally not.
you know, it would be impossible, it would outrage the nation.
Yeah, completely.
I think the answer to that is back to the both and, not either or. So you're not faced with opposing the nationalist agenda. You're saying, well, there is that, but there is also this, which comes out of the same thing. And when you put the two together, the nationalist agenda can't stay the same, because you conflated it with another one, and something new arises.
Yes, but the archetype one has been the power, doesn't it?
Sure, but
we're always trumping on power.
The archetype, is, in my view, is multifaceted.
Yeah, that's right.
So the nationalist agenda sees as one part of it, says this is it.
Yeah.
You say, yeah, there is that, but there is also.
I think a good example of that is St. George.
Mm.
Right, St. George is obviously the kind of patron saint of British Welsh, British nationalism in some ways. But of course, St. George is a Lydian. He's not British. He's a sort of Roman auxiliary, if there's anything. And there's
Lydia
some.
Or Libya?
Hmm?
Libya or Lydia?
Lydian. I think it's St. George.
Turkey, yeah?
Yeah, it's Turkey, Anatolia. So there's a way in which you can. I mean, we'll come on to this later, but there's a way in which you can work with the archetype of St. George in his Lydian form that can help to kind of, if you like, to transform that transform the kind of the distorted image of St. George driving foreigners from our shores.
Mm.
Because the archetype is, you know, as in the same way that we have shadow sides and light sides, so do archetypes. So there's an aspect of St. George that actually is this being of light, being of goodness. There's another aspect of St. George that is thought of as being the kind of the warrior who drives the foreigners from our shores. And by engaging with that archetype, if you feel called on to do that, you by being present with the archetype, present with the light and the shadow of the archetype, you start to bring a different energy into being. Now, one of the theses behind this the work that we're doing is you can do that simply on the subtle levels without it manifesting in any external form, and that will have its own effect. My friend David Spangler calls subtle activism.
Yeah.
But of course, also you can write about St. George, you can talk about St. George, you can bring a different concept of into being that helps the national consciousness to transform around this. In some ways, even people knowing that St. George is British, you know, is a useful thing. The St. George is Turkish, right? Actually, is an useful idea to put out in the world. It's a bit kind of complicated for the British National Party, but who don't like that. But just the very knowing of that puts a seed of something else out into the world.
Hitler did the opposite, didn't he? Because he hijacked he used lots of symbolism and archetypes and stuff, just enormously.
Well, Hitler was incredibly effective at doing that, you know, and you look at the Nuremberg rallies, you can really see how imagery, symbolism is used to create a different, you know, I mean, the Germans were one of the most civilized nations in Europe before. But out of their national despair and shame after the First World War and Hitler's manipulation of that and the creation of a new German identity, the identity of the Herrenvolk, the master race, you know, he mobilizes a whole, you know, a whole nation to go and do the most horrendous things.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a master of design. You look at Nazi building design, you look at the uniforms, you look at it's all sharp-edged and beautiful looking, but sharp-edged, because that's the energy. That's the sort of and the energy of the Herrenvolk, the master, you know, so people who felt defeated and ashamed suddenly are told they are the Herrenvolk, the master race. You know, and so he tapped into very powerful kind of energies in the psyche. And this is the level of the energy that we're talking about. When we touch the deep, we're touching these very ancient, powerful energies that have their own own life within the collective consciousness.
Is there a similarly powerful image or archetype that might be useful for now, in a way, thinking about an interconnected universe where we all create the future together?
I think it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of what are the dreams that are arising somewhere.
Gaia,
sir. So Gaia is the key image, right? So actually that's one of the things that I... So if we think of, okay, what is the antidote, really, to a lot of these disturbances? The image of Gaia as the living earth, as this kind of feminine creative energy... That's connected with ecology, that's connected with joining together.
Countess patriarchy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that idea of the living earth, the living universe, the sort of the... as well as even calling it Gaia, almost the image of the kind of the deep mother, the deep goddess, the deep feminine energy that arises... And that is almost formless because she hasn't yet revealed herself. You know, and Gaia is one of the outer. In some ways, I think Gaia is one of the outer edges, outer shapes that energy clothes itself in. Mm. You know, there's something about this sort of because in a way, what's gone wrong? If we think about what's gone wrong, well, partly what's gone wrong is patriarchy gone mad. The technological mind gone completely bloody crazy and so almost the counterbalance there, which is the feminine creative energy, the moon energy, the energy of the deep earth and the seas, is the energy that's kind of needed. You know, it's why we find Dion Fortune in the 20s writing all these novels of which there's a really excellent book that people can buy. Whose name escapes me, but it's why you find her. It's why you find her writing about these things, about a different kind of relationship between the masculine and the feminine. Right? I mean, she's very prophetic in a way in the '20s because she's addressing the need for something long before we ever knew all the terrible bloody things we were going to do to the earth. She's writing about the kind of the need for the feminine creative power to arise differently, to come together in a new form. D.H. Lawrence does the same thing in The Rainbow. You get right at the end of The Rainbow, you get this image of the I forget the name of the female character now, Ursula Brangwyn, who is the rainbow bridge into the new world. And he contrasts this image of the kind of sterile, grey, oppressed working classes with this image of the woman who holds open the rainbow, a rainbow of new possibilities. Mm. Now these writers are writing when they are genuinely prophetic, really, because this is before the rainbow flag becomes an important image, before the kind of, you know, so again they're tapping into these dreams that are arising out of the kind of collective. Mm.
In a way, it's also the stage on which everything's being played out now with the abuse of women and the Me Too.
Yeah,
and everything.
Completely, absolutely. This is another echo of all that in a way. You know, that sort of, because actually, if we look at what's happened there with what's in Weisenstein, you know, the sort of extraordinary stuff that has been known and taken for granted for many years suddenly becomes unacceptable.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's been a shift. How that come? It's come into the light, and it's seen simply as unacceptable and not tolerable. When of course it's been tolerated for decades. You know, so that centuries, of course, when we take the longer view. Suddenly, but this is how I think we get a sense for what is emerging, and you see it emerging in all kinds of different places because it. When something from the deep emerges, it's got all kinds of access points that it starts to appear from. So it appears in ecological thinking, it appears in political thinking. You can, you know, and of course it has that sense of disruption in it as it arises. It overturns existing paradigms, overturns existing political structures and ideas.
How
just what the internet has that subversive energy, doesn't it, the internet? So it's allowed that sort of communication, the Me Too thing was only possible through that immediate way of communicating.
That's certainly one of the advantages of the internet. The internet, of course, can also be used to suppress stuff as well, really, and that's... Because the other thing we have happening in the internet at the moment are national governments subverting the internet and using it to imprison. So there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment in terms of these kind of deeper energies emerging.
And how to have, in a way, that things like Me Too, of course, can divide even more.
Yes.
And in a way, when you said the Gaia, I thought, well, of course, it's Gaia. And then I was like, because it's so easily rejected by those who don't support it. Oh, of course, Gaia was hippie, woolly. It just feels like new vocabulary is needed.
Well, that's why Gaia. That's why Gaia isn't quite right, right? So that's why I say Gaia is one of the sort of faces of this.
Knows,
but actually, what it does it now? It's much more like there's this primal. Feminine energy arising, I suppose, that reframes everything. Because
I was just thinking of the word that came up for me as the archetype was sovereignty, around which there is currently a huge battle.
Yeah,
well, to own sovereignty.
Yeah.
And yet, going back to the Gawain story and Lady Ragnall,
yeah.
Sovereignty was specifically about choice.
Yeah,
that's right. Archetype of choice in terms of sovereignty got, in my view, hijacked by a group of people who say this is what sovereignty is and put it in a particular context. They confine it. And in my view, the job is to free sovereignty from that confinement and redefine it or say, yes, it partly that, but it is also something else.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't close down the rest of it.
Yeah. No, I think that's right, and I think that's another octave of the process.
I suppose that's why I've kind of been very excited, I suppose, about doing workshops around leadership again, because it just feels like, like the sovereign, it has been a hijacked word, and to actually go beyond the concept of that. But also what you gave us this weekend, I think I was so excited by those words, the anthropos and... Mm.
Apostolon.
It kind of feels like it's almost like it comes before gender.
Yes, it does. Yes, absolutely. Both
it's
do.
It's kind of beneath it and above it and around it.
Yeah.
And the archetype of being a human being, it's something about almost like going beyond these things. And of course, we can't go beyond without going through as well. So it's not kind of leapfrog something.
No, the other thing that's emerging, of course, that's interesting in this territory is transgender. Because actually the other thing that's interesting, if we look at what's emerging, gender is getting reframed. So the very very fixed notion of gender that we used to have is increasingly being... So this idea of being anthropos first and not being a man or a woman is more and more pivotal, more and more essential, and being challenged by things, again, happening in numbers of different places simultaneously.
Yes, it's interesting because it's got an end. That anthropos is a human being. A man is Anna and woman is Jan, something like that. Isn't it? But anthropos is
a goddess.
Which English doesn't really have. We have to use man for both.
For both, that's right.
Group is appallingly sexist society. But
it's appallingly sexist.
It does mean a human being.
No, it does give us a word that does it. I mean, I'm not holding a brief for ancient Greece. They were appallingly sexist against women, but the word is useful because it gives us a non-gendered word. You know, it's
there's a need for new sword energy. It was what came up for me when you said that guys too easily dismissed, like the need for a sword energy, but having broken down the patriarchal, so it's in the service of Gaia, or, and again, not pre-gender kind of. I'm using my language.
No. I think you're touching on something there. But I think it's true that Gaia isn't it really, because the trouble is Gaia is something already known, and dismissed. It's something more primal.
Because it's associated with feminine. And yes. So therefore it is dismissed.
That's right, exactly.
Or with a kind of thinking which is ecological and already non-neutral.
Yes, that's right,
so it's
exactly.
It's almost like, actually, what are the new neutral words that we can, from different sides,
yes, right.
gravitate towards or own?
Have you heard about this Ecocide campaign?
Yeah.
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, in the past, it's always been quite legal to trash the environment, and protesters are usually accused of criminal acts. Mm. But if this bill goes through to make ecocide a crime, in the Treaty of Marseille, somewhere that sort of sets international law, if ecocide becomes a crime, then the people who perpetrate it will be the criminals. People who protest against it will be the good guys. And there's been a group working for about 5 years to sort of, there are loopholes in the law that would allow this to happen. Yeah. And it's sort of just coming out into the open now.
Polly Higgins, she's the kind of the environmental lawyer that's been championing.
Oh, that's right. She's been doing it.
And there's this woman called Jojo something who's, well, she's doing a lot in this, you know, she's sort of a right-hand person who's disseminating all this out.
Mm.
But it's just on Facebook now, so it's just, you know, going public. Because when we all got fired up when I heard her talk, and we said, what can we do? He said, don't do anything yet. Don't do anything, we're just getting it. And now obviously they've started launching this. But so without even using terms, because I like Gaia, because actually, although we know what it means, it actually means the living earth. Mm. Which is less gendered than these phrases like the Greek mother, which will push people's buttons even more,
Well, there's two different things going on here, Benny, because there is the how we use language, which I think is right, but there's also something about what is emerged, what is the deep energy that's emerging, and in some ways I think we don't know how to name that, because it's pre-named.
Yes.
You know, there's something about something primal, something that breaks down categories. That is emergent, and because it's emergent, it hasn't yet acquired a shape, a recognizable shape. But we can see the octaves or the shadows of the shape in the things that are emerging. So in the overturning of patriarchal energies in different places, in the rise of transgenderism, in the rise of ideas like ecocide, you can start to see the emergence of something its time has come. And we can, it's too soon to give it names. Name and form.
It's like the naming destroys the primal energy.
Yeah.
Yes.
As soon as you've named it, you've limited it, you've wrapped it in a way that restricts it.
Yes.
And the next wave is about breaking that restriction.
Yeah.
And we need to name it.
And we need to name it.
Then you have to get the energy of disruption up again.
Yeah, but we also have to name it as part of birth, is to be
part of the conversation.
It's part of the conversation. Yeah. That part has yet to arrive and is emergent. So that and of course it's emergent as well when you talk, Rob, about the internet, the sense of the globalized world, the intimate smaller world that it used to be. You know, when I was brought up, Swansea was 5 miles away. And was a different universe, Actually, now we can look and see what's happening in East Turkey, so the world has become more intimate in that sense, less intimate as well from another point of view. But everything's on the shadow side. But in a way, I suppose that's the as we proceed on with these last weekends. As well as looking at our relationship to the imaginal, it's also looking at this place that something is actively emerging at the moment. And it's being at the service of that, getting interested in that, being challenged by that, being inspired by that. And absolutely being part of it. I think that's of course pivotal. And it But its energy is radical, the stuff you got at the meaning conference. You know, categories are breaking down because actually something very fundamental is happening.
Yeah. I went to this Mindell training, process work training in London.
Yeah.
There was about 80 people in the room. And one of the first things that someone said is, can we go around the room and everyone say what pronoun they would like to be referred to as?
Wow.
And of course, you know, like, you could go, oh my God, how politically correct to think. But actually, it was really
powerful. That's very interesting.
Yeah, to go every single person, my name is Blur, and if you talk about me in the third person, I'd like you to use they.
Yeah.
Because they're, I mean, but it wasn't just because there was some transgender in the room, but it was so we all think about that in a different
yes, way. Exactly. That's right.
The fact that everyone still calls everyone guys. It's like, it's my bugbear. I'm going, fuck, I'm not a guy. Do not call me a guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, kind of go beyond categories. But just, again, that sense of the language that we use can narrow or make things smaller or kill things.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And also we need to talk about things to bring into being as well.
Well, that's right, and that's the whole nature, just to be right by the beginning of the weekend. This is the nature of logos, this is the nature of conversation. It's the nature and the nature of the word that gives life or kills, right? That's the fundamental, that brings us neat as we just end there. This brings us right back to the beginning of the weekend. This is in arche email ho logos. In the beginning is the word, in the beginning is the conversation. The beginningness is the mystery, the word is the manifest, and the conversation is the manifest process that's continually shimmering and flickering between the mystery and manifestation.
You can't have conversation without words.
No, you have to.
You can't,
but well, it doesn't go too well.
Just think about Gaia, and then how in fact how you really create that bridge is through the image of the polar bear struggling, and suddenly that polar bear becomes it's like the stone, it becomes the vehicle for the conversation.
Yes, that's right.
I was thinking how the twin-headed eagle of Nazi Germany, that's so much more powerful a symbol than Gaia. It's,
yeah, that's right.
But it can go.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's stop and just take a breath. Take just a breath.